You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here for MLB.com Extras, taking you around the National League East. Some teams are headed home for the offseason, other teams heading on to October. We'll cover them all in this trip around the division.
Anthony, we're going to start with sort of some breaking news here, but not really a surprise as far as that news goes, and that is Steven Matz is, in fact, done for the year. They've decided to go in, do the surgery, take care of the spur in the elbow, the bone spur in the elbow. It was starting to feel like this was going to happen and we weren't going to see him again, but now the Mets know, I guess, and they can go forward with their plan for the next week and hopefully the postseason, knowing that Steven Matz is not an option.
Yeah, this surgery was inevitable. The Mets said it way back in, I want to say, June, that he was going to have his bone spur removed from his elbow. So it wasn't a secret. The only thing that's changed is that we're here now in late September, the final days of September, and Matz was still dealing with that impingement in his left shoulder. Did not look like he was going to get back on a mound anytime soon. So there was really no reason for the Mets to continue to hold out hope and continue to have him try and pitch and, you know, possibly make the whole situation worse. They decided just to shut him down. He will get the bone spur removed. He will get plenty of rest over the winter, which will help the shoulder out as well. And given all that, given these extra few weeks now that he will have, there's certainly optimism that Steven Matz will be ready to go and back at full strength by spring training. Certainly a tough season for Steven Matz. He started out so great, 7-1, won that seven starts in a row after the bad one his first time out, and really looked like he was going to be right there with Corey Seager's of the world for National League Rookie of the Year. It just didn't happen. Struggled to pitch through the discomfort in his elbow. And let's all remember, he gets lumped together with Noah Syndergaard sometimes because Syndergaard also has a bone spur in his elbow. But Matz's was much, much bigger, was brushing up against more inflammation on a daily, weekly basis. And only he knows how much pain he was really pitching through, but it clearly was something that affected him. And this was a surgery, again, that was inevitable that he needed to get done. The Mets have decided that now is the time, and they will be without him if they advance to postseason play.
So now we sit here in the last week of the season, no Matz, no DeGrom, no Harvey, no Wheeler, but they still get lifts from other guys. That said, none of that mattered on Monday night, where things kind of just went in a different direction for the Mets. Because of the scheduling, they were in Miami. They happened to be in Miami for the first Marlins game after the tragic death of Jose Fernandez on Sunday in a boat accident. And you were down there last night, Anthony. Emotional pregame ceremony with the Marlins. And I think the Mets really made it more special for the Marlins by going out on the field, sharing in it, hugging them. I think that set the tone for the game. And I think for a little while, even though the Mets are in the middle of a pennant race, nobody was really thinking that much about that.
Well, they're human beings, Tim. And anyone who saw that ceremony, who happened to be here in Miami or watched it on television, could see just how raw and how open that wound was. And the Mets obviously had a front row seat for that. They saw everything the Marlins were going through. They were out there on the field, like you said, shaking hands, hugging the Marlins. And these are guys, by and large, that the Mets know, aside from seeing them 19 times a year in spring training. A lot of them will spend time together in the off season. They might live in similar areas. They might train in similar areas. There are a lot of personal connections here that I think people forget sometimes. And even if there weren't, obviously this is a situation that transcends baseball, and the Mets realized that. It was an extraordinarily difficult thing for either team to go out there and play a baseball game after that. I wish I could put into words what the atmosphere was like here. It wasn't a baseball stadium. It wasn't a baseball game. It was a wake. It was a funeral. It was, what you'd expect from that type of thing. And then to go out and have to not just play a game, but in the Mets' case, play a game in the midst of a pennant race, a game they really, wanted to have. It was tough. It was difficult. And, they tried to turn the page as best they could. They're still in the process of doing that. These games in Miami this week will all be tough. And they continue to try and turn the page because that's really all they can do. And I thought one of the best things anyone said was Terry Collins saying, look, Jose Fernandez loved this game. He loved the game of baseball. He played it with a passion and a joy that very few others do. And the best way we can honor him is to do the same, to go out there and play the game of baseball the right way, the best way we know how. And certainly that's what the Mets are trying to do this week.
Yeah, and it was powerful. And it seemed the moment that D. Gordon hit that leadoff home run, it just kind of, there was a special energy on the Marlins side that they were able to kind of carry through the game and get the victory. But I wonder how they'll be able to bounce back even the next day. It's certainly going to be a tough week for that Marlins team. As far as the Mets go, there is a pennant race here going, and they still are in the driver's seat for that first wild card spot, despite all these injuries and everything that's going on. And to go back to Sunday, Anthony, they win 17-0, and obviously the offense gets the headlines. But maybe the bigger story in that one was Robert Gsellman. 7 scoreless innings, 3 hits, as these other pitchers that nobody had heard of until this season continue to step up for this team.
Yeah, they wouldn't be in this spot right now. And you say it's a pennant race. It's a real good pennant race because we stand here as we're recording this podcast with 5 games left in the season, and it's entirely plausible that the Mets could host the NL Wild Card at Citi Field. And it's entirely plausible they could miss the postseason altogether. So it's that tight, game and a half separating 3 teams. And you nailed it with whether it's Robert Gsellman or Seth Lugo or even some of the less heralded guys. Gabriel Ynoa has given them some better innings of late. Rafael Montero, well, he struggled in a couple of spot starts, kept them in games. And, you know, that's been so critical to the Mets. And I think what Gsellman's last outing really did was it gave them confidence going forward into the postseason that he can be not just an option, but a viable option. We talked earlier in this podcast about how the Mets are without Matt Harvey and Jacob deGrom, Steven Matz. So Robert Gsellman's going to need to start a playoff game if the Mets make it. Seth Lugo is going to need to start a playoff game if the Mets make it. And beyond that, you know, you're looking at a rotation now that Bartolo Colon and Noah Syndergaard are lined up to pitch games 161 and 162 for the Mets. Now, that could change if they clinch early, but there's a very good chance that the Mets are going to need to use those guys, in which case a Robert Gsellman might very well be the guy standing out there on the mound for the National League wildcard game. Certainly not how the Mets drew it up in April, but when you look at what he's done lately, I think the Mets are growing more and more comfortable with that prospect.
Todd, final week of the regular season for the Phillies as they wrap up a year that was really dedicated to getting experience, to getting young pitchers on the mound, to getting position players out there, and really starting to rebuild this thing. But around baseball, and I think especially around the National League East, it was obviously a terrible weekend with the news of Jose Fernandez's tragic death and the boat accident in Miami. The Phillies obviously play the Marlins a lot and have seen Jose Fernandez a lot, and you've seen him a lot in your time covering the Phillies. What stood out to you as far as Jose Fernandez, the pitcher?
Well, a few things really stood out. I mean, one, obviously, he was a ridiculously, tremendously talented pitcher. He was so much fun to watch. Like, he was one of those guys where you go, okay, we could be seeing a no-hitter tonight. Let's pay attention to every pitch and every play. Second of all, his enthusiasm, the love that he had playing the game, I know everybody has talked about that. You know, he's always smiling. He was always having a lot of fun. But the third thing that really stood out to me is a few of the times I remember seeing this at Marlins Park during Marlins batting practice. You know, every ballpark will have some fans behind the ropes behind home plate during batting practice. And, you know, they're there for whatever reason. They know somebody in the front office. They're there because they won a raffle or they won an auction item. Sometimes it's, you know, kids, you know, fighting childhood cancer, whatever the case may be. And I'll tell you what, there were more than a few times when I saw Jose Fernandez just walk over there and talk to kids, talk to fans, take selfies. You know, he did this more than a few times, like I said, and that stood out for one big reason. Not everybody does that, and I'm not saying that in a bad way, but, you know, baseball players, they have so much asked of them in terms of time, et cetera. And batting practice, they're there to work, you know, and not a lot of people realize that. So they can't always go over and talk to every single kid, take a selfie with every single kid. But Jose seemed to really enjoy doing that. He seemed to really enjoy that interaction with the fans. And in fact, that, you know, that is one of the things that when we were talking about, you know, me and some other people with the Phillies were talking about Jose Fernandez. That's really the thing that stood out to me more than anything, because, like I said, you don't see every player do that all the time. I don't mean it in a bad way, like I said. I mean it in a very complimentary way of Jose Fernandez, because, you know, he knew that he could really touch some people's lives by just going over and saying hello. And he loved to do that, and that really showed me a lot about him as a person.
Yeah, and it's been very clear since the tragedy. Everyone who's spoken about Jose Fernandez, before they talk about him, the baseball player, they're talking about Jose Fernandez, the person, first, and what a bright light he was. All right, moving on to the Phillies. And this season, like I said, they're kind of, you know, it's been a season of change for the Phillies. But this week we see Ryan Howard hit his 15th career grand slam. Has it been kind of neat here over the last month as he kind of finishes off his time with Phillies? He's had some big moments along the way here, Todd.
Yeah, it is. I think a lot of people earlier in the season were concerned that if he finished out the season with the team that, you know, he would really continue his struggles, and it would be kind of a sad thing to watch, quite frankly. But he has hit the ball a lot better, really, I think, since early July. He's been pretty productive in limited playing time, but it is good to see him kind of go out on that note, hitting some home runs, having some big moments, you know, kind of giving fans, you know, a few more things to cheer about before he departs the Phillies' organization. So hopefully these final three games at Citizens Bank Park to close out the season, I expect him to start all three of those games. And, you know, it would be nice if certainly he hit one out. It would be unbelievable if he hit one out each day. And I expect the Phillies to recognize his contribution to the organization in some way. And, you know, it goes without saying that he's, you know, the greatest first baseman in franchise history. You know, they don't win that 2008 World Series without him. They don't win two NL pennants without him. They don't win five straight NL East titles without him from 2007 to 2011. You know, really just a force in that Phillies' lineup for years and years. And I think sometimes that gets forgotten a little bit because, you know, that team had great pitching. It had Chase Utley and Jimmy Rollins and all these other stars on the team. But really, without Ryan Howard dropping him in that fourth spot in the lineup, he played almost every single day. He knocked in a ton of runs. I really don't see the Phillies as enjoying the success that they had if they did not have him on that roster back then.
The Phillies have A.J. Ellis is obviously, since the trade coming over for Ruiz, he's become, I think, a staple here for the Phillies. Is there a chance that the Phillies could try to bring A.J. Ellis back for 2017? Because with all these young pitchers, it would be nice to have a veteran catcher for them.
I think it would definitely behoove the Phillies to explore that opportunity. In fact, this week, talking to Pete McCann, we were talking about the catching situation for 2017. And, you know, Cameron Rupp has earned the right to be the number one catcher next season. His offensive production is amongst the best of qualified catchers in Major League Baseball. But we asked Pete, okay, what do you think about the backup situation? Do you want a veteran in that spot? Jorge Alfaro's up right now. Could you maybe, you know, kind of ease him in in a backup role? And he said flat out, he's like, listen, I really think it's important to have a veteran in that spot. He said, we really benefited from having Carlos Ruiz on this team through August, and then A.J. Ellis replacing Carlos Ruiz. And I definitely see his point. You know, Cameron Rupp still has some room to grow defensively, calling games, et cetera. And, you know, I think Pete McCann and the coaching staff would like to have a veteran to help him out, and as well as work with some of these young pitchers. You know, after Vince Velasquez made his final start of the season, A.J. basically said, listen, I'm going to give you some homework since you basically have nothing to do the last month of the year. So he basically gave him a homework assignment. He said, who do you like to watch pitch? Who do you kind of see yourself in? He said, Zach Greinke. He's like, all right, I want you to watch all of Zach Greinke starts from last year and figure out what works for him and see how you can maybe incorporate some of his style, some of his strategy into your own game. So next year you can take another step forward. I think that,
Mark, you talk about teams wanting to finish the regular season strong if they're not in the postseason, kind of get some momentum heading into the offseason. Well, you can't do that any better than the Braves are doing right now. As we record this podcast, they've won 10 of 11, which is unbelievable when you think back to what this team was doing back in April. Just talk about the vibe around this team right now. Obviously, they've been out of it as far as contention goes for a long time, but they are doing damage right now in the National League.
There's no doubt. They have turned things around. They started to turn things around there in June. You started to see a team that could be much closer to the 500 team. You still saw some ups and downs with their rotation. Obviously, we've spoken about it numerous times. The offense took a completely different look once they added Matt Kemp. He lengthened the lineup, gave Freddie Freeman protection, and at the same time, they were putting Ender Inciarte at the top of the lineup there. For this team to play as well as it has here down the stretch, this is exactly what this team wanted and needed. You know, you bring a guy like Dansby Swanson up, and he gets to be around something like this, that would have been the fear, right? You know. They said you want to bring up a guy and give him big league experience. And then, you know, there's always a counter argument. Someone might say, well, you know, you really want to bring him up and subject him to some guys that might be miserable down the stretch. Well, there's been no reason for this to be miserable. Here for the last month, I forget exactly how many games it was back to August 21st. They got the fourth best winning percentage in the National League, or actually in the majors. And like you said, to win 10 of 11 down the stretch here, beat some division opponents. They're going to exit this season. Just one more win this weekend against the Tigers. They'll have as many wins as they did last year. Now, that's not an accomplishment over the course of a full season, but when you think about where they were, especially when Freddie Gonzalez was fired at 9-28, I believe it was, back in May, this team has a different look, a different feel, and I think that's the most important thing is the guys in the clubhouse are happy, and that's one reason why they may hire Brian Snicker as the manager.
And that is exactly what I was going to talk to you about next. You have Brian Snicker, who's obviously had a very positive effect on this team, and I get the feeling, Mark, that when he was first hired as an interim manager, the thought was, hey, he's an interim manager. We're going to go out and we're going to get the guy that we want in the offseason. But he's done such a good job. Then you have the other internal candidates, Terry Pendleton, Bo Porter. This is a Braves franchise that has always seemingly looked within before going outside kind of the Braves family to do hirings like this. If you had to kind of handicap the race to be the manager for 2017, how would you put it right now?
No, I'll make it a three-horse race with Brian Snicker being the heavy favorite. I'd say if you want me to put percentages on it, I'll go with Snit at we'll go 70% and maybe Terry Pendleton at 40 and Eddie Perez at 10. I don't think Bo Porter may get an interview, but I don't see him really as a candidate. Other than, you know, they will, just because he's here already, they'll talk to him. But I think that just Snicker has made such an impact in that clubhouse. You know, the argument is, okay, what have other interim managers done after they've been fired or hired full-time? I counter that with, you know what, other teams haven't, when they've hired interim managers, they haven't necessarily been in this same position where they're nearing the end of what they hope is a rebuild, where they got very fortunate to fill a hole there in left field with a deal that basically looked like just a contract, two teams changing back contracts with Kemp for Oliveira. And then you bring up Swanson. I mean, this is a team that has not only changed its identity under Brian Snicker, because the players, you know, have a lot of respect for him. He keeps things loose. He's very organized. And much of this credit should go to Terry Pendleton because of what he's done as the bench coach. But I think that this is a team that you don't necessarily look at just like every other interim manager, because a lot of times a guy's given an interim job mainly because that team is maybe in a decline at that point in time. So, I think Brian Snicker proved to all of us that Yeah, I have been a minor league manager for a long time. He's never been a big league manager before this year, but he was able to handle that clubhouse. He's able to handle the media responsibilities, all the other stuff he wouldn't have done at the minor league level. And while it's not a slam dunk that he gets the job, I think there will be a lot of people surprised if it's not.
How quickly do you think the team makes that decision?
You know what? I was thinking they might do it this weekend, but they may wait and maybe I interview a couple of external candidates. If I had to guess, if we had done this interview yesterday, I'd have said I definitely would have anticipated it this weekend. But maybe some things I've heard over the last day or two led me to believe that maybe they'll wait, interview some guys, and then pick one of those days during October where they're allowed to make news, you know, an off day where there aren't any games being played. So I do think it'll be, while there's still a possibility of this weekend, I'm thinking it will come, you know, as early as possible in October.
Mark, Freddie Freeman's 30-game hit streak was snapped at 30 games, still the longest in baseball this season. And we've talked about it pretty much the last three or four podcasts, just the unbelievable season he's had and the MVP-type numbers he's putting up despite being on a team that will probably keep him from really being seriously considered for that award. But as you see the 30-game hit streak come to an end and historic as far as length, as far as the Braves go as well, has there been a point in his career, I know as a season this is his best season, but has there been a point in his career where he's ever been as good as he's been over this streak?
No, this 30-game hitting streak's unique, and it's, but in some ways, you know what, it's basically been a continuation of a lot of the stretches we've seen since the middle of June. He got hot there in the middle of June. He did kind of slightly cool off, and during a portion of July, started to get hot again. But this is basically that 30-game streak dated back to August 24th. We've basically seen this since August 5th, which was 3 days after Matt Kemp joined the lineup and provided Freddie the protection that he's lacked the last couple of years, you know, especially since Justin Upton's been gone. Needed that right-hand protection. And, you can't just put a guy there and say he's going to protect you. Matt Kemp has continued to prove valuable enough, productive enough to serve as a protector. But Freddie Freeman's swing is so simple and powerful. The question is, you know, you're obviously, you know, you're impressed with stretches like this and the numbers that he has put up, but you're even amazed that a guy could struggle like he did at the beginning of this season. Look, it's just a reminder that everybody struggles in this game, but this is, he's a guy that has throughout his career been able to keep kill slumps really quickly.
Joe, I know it's been an impossible week for the Marlins dealing with the tragic death of Jose Fernandez last Sunday morning. And, of course, you're right there in it as a beat reporter. So, first of all, thanks for taking some time to do the podcast this week because I know it's been a tough week.
Yeah. It's been, incredibly difficult and moving and, just being around the team and knowing Jose on a personal level and, just this devastating news. And, it's something that really, you hear the cliches about family, and it's like that's exactly what happened. You know, the community and this at so many fronts. This is a really, really devastating week and time for the Marlins.
Joe, from Monday's emotional game against the Mets and, of course, D. Gordon's home run, which was a surreal thing, and then obviously the memorial on Wednesday, funeral service on Thursday, and then the team had that day off before they go to D.C., how much do you think it's helped these players, helped this team, the fact that we are in the season and they've kind of had each other this whole week?
Well, that part's helped, but, their off day is going to a funeral. So I don't know how much of a, an off day that is, especially to, their own, So it's hard to really tend to find the silver lining in any of it, except for that it was close to the end of the year, because you're going to find a lot of people just ready for Sunday to come and go. And, into the off season that fell short of where they wanted it to go, you know, the playoffs. But it's, you know, they saw a larger than life experience that many, you know, knowing, you know, like Terry Common told Don Mattingly, you know, sorry he had to go through it. No one should have to go through it. And it's obvious no one should have to go through something like this with someone of any age, but especially a 24-year-old at the height, you know, just starting to break through and be what he might have been in terms of, you know, community, obviously in terms of the game and the branding of this game internationally and just what he meant to so many people. That's what I'm taking from the weekend, just being at the memorial at Marlins Park the other day and seeing people young and old, people his age, a couple of years younger than him, and then seeing older people talking to some, you know, Cuban Americans born in Cuba who made their way here and what he means to them, and seeing people weep and collapse pretty much to the ground in tears on someone they never even met, but just, you know, love as a baseball player. So, you know, it's kind of hard to get any solace in anything, except for, I will say this, if, like Giancarlo said the other day, he didn't think their team could get any closer together, and they really did. And everything you saw Monday night, you know, pre and post game, all kind of just happened organically, as they said, and everything from the heart. And, you know, somehow they're going by on fumes. It's really kind of unfortunate that to play, you know, because they're, you know, for them to play not, you know, this game's difficult enough to play with everything right, but to play either on minimal sleep, clearly with their mind distracted, is kind of hard to watch that aspect of it.
Yeah, and the Mets were such a big part of it on Monday night and through that series as well, Joe. And I, you mentioned the effect he had on people, and listening to Scott Boras speak Thursday at the funeral. Scott Boras is a guy that I think people envision as this just cutthroat agent, but to listen to him talk about Jose the person, that was really powerful, I thought, as well. So the team won on Monday, obviously fueled by, I think, just emotion and heart, and then they lose on Tuesday and Wednesday. Now they go to D.C. It seemed like they just kind of ran out of that gas in those other two games. How does this team rally to play three more games this weekend?
Yeah, you know, Tim, they're doing it basically, like you said, on adrenaline, on fumes, and the fact that this is what they do. They play baseball. It's, as Don Mattingly said, it's kind of their safe space. And, you know, if there's anything that we've kind of drawn from this, is this team was really tight. And Giancarlo said the other day, he goes, I didn't know if this team could get any tighter. And they clearly did. And, you know, we're seeing their, you know, their resolve clearly. And, you know, another thing I found interesting is, you know, a lot of the players talked about the fun Jose had playing. Now, players, everyone has their own personality. Obviously, Jose Fernandez's personality was that of outgoing. He was a showman. He was an entertainer. And he played with his level of fire, and no one should be who they aren't. But, you know, I've talked to a number of players that talked about, you know, just wanting to almost have a little bit more fun out there. Maybe it's, even if it's just kind of recognizing it's still a game. And, you know, so we'll see if anyone plays with a little bit more emotion, you know, other than just the emotion of playing with hurt over the, you know, the loss of a teammate.
Joe, one player who's been in the middle of all this is Martin Prado, obviously a team leader for the Marlins and one of the veterans on a really young team. And in the middle of all this, it comes out that he agreed on an extension with the Marlins that is, I think, key for this team going forward. But he's been such a leader in this situation and through it all. How important is it for the Marlins to keep Martin Prado on for the next 3 years?
Yeah, that kind of was in the works for several weeks, and it had been going back and forth, and I think it's something that they haven't officially announced yet, and that may come, you know, either before we leave Washington, or maybe they want to wait till we get back to Miami next week and make an official announcement. But Prado was basically their top offseason priority. Now, obviously, they're going to be looking for, you know, a high-end pitcher. it's, you know, I don't know if you'd say, yeah, clearly they're looking for an ace, but who says they're going into the offseason looking for an ace? You got to look for as much high-end pitching as you can get. So, but yeah, and in terms of Prado, he's kind of been the glue to this pretty much since they acquired him from New York. Now, last year when they got him, you know, he was still getting his feet wet here in Miami and wasn't even sure of his future past, you know, the first year. There were rumors he could have been traded at the deadline in 15. So at the second half of last year, his leadership really took to the forefront. And Prado, to a player, is as important as anybody this organization's had in a long time. So retaining him was a high priority. And it also is kind of a signal as well that they intend to keep a majority of this core together and try to add as much as possible. They may have to subtract some players. You know, all teams are going to be doing, you know, some sort of moving in the offseason. But it seems that they want this team to kind of, at least the core, to grow together and keep growing and see how much they can add.
All right, Joe, thanks for taking a few minutes for us. And your coverage on MLB.com through this tragic week has been tremendous as well.
They've laid the foundation of a really, really competitive team here. I think the starting with the pitching rotation is deep. And then when you start talking about position player-wise, you got the best player in the National League, possibly on earth, hitting third for you every night.
We all want to win. And we want to win now. And we have the personnel we feel, you know, to win.
2-2, Harper high in the air, right field. See you later. His fourth career opening day home run.
Why not four with one swing for 100?
And there it goes! See you later, number 100!
I mean, it's like you're watching a movie. You watch this guy play every day. I mean, that's curtain call. If he's ever had a curtain call, it's right now.
Washington Nationals, they're making the long-term investment in their number one overall pick in 2009. Inking right-hander Steven Strasburg to a seven-year extension with $175 million.
You know, I really feel like this organization is going to be, you know, winning and succeeding for many years to come, and, you know, I definitely want to be a part of that.
35,000 plus, the wind, the pitch. It is in there, strike three, goal! He has struck out a new Nationals record, 18 men in the game. Now the kick, here it comes. Swing and a miss, swing and a miss! He struck him out with a slide. He has tied the Major League record for strikeouts in a game with 20 strikeouts. Randy Johnson, Kerry Wood, Roger Clemens, and now Max Scherzer. Murphy launches one deep right center, and he's done it! 2-0 Nationals.
Well, if you want a sneaky choice for a quarter way through the season MVP of the National League, you're looking at him right there.
The kick and the pitch by Gomez. Swing and a line drive. Base hit center field. Harper has scored. Here comes Espinoza. Throw to the plate. He is safe. It's a earthquake. It's a win.
So Granderson, Cabrera, and Cespedes, the first three hitters Lucas Giolito will face.
Currently rated by MLB.com, the number one prospect in Major League Baseball.
Not running, swing and a miss. Strikeout, number one in the major leagues for Lucas Giolito. Espinoza, deep left center. This one is his second grand slam. Espinoza takes a shot. Deep left center. He's done it from both sides of the plate.
I just found out that he's the first National to hit a home run from both sides. That's quite a feat.
And Murphy to right. See you later. They keep booing. He keeps slugging. 10 RBIs in this series. And against the Mets this year, 7 homers, 21 batted in.
And Steven Strasburg now is 13-0 for the season as he gives up just 3 hits and 1 run over 8 innings.
Big news of the day, the Nationals acquiring closer Mark Melancon in a trade with the Pirates, giving up Felipe Rivero and a left-handed pitching prospect, Taylor Hearn.
The kick and the pitch to Penn. Swing and a miss! Swing and a miss! And the ball in the dirt. Ramos will throw to first to Murphy. It's the first save in a Nationals uniform for Mark Melancon.
Worth on a 3-2 pitch. It is fair. 46 games in a row on base, tying the all-time
franchise record of Rusty stops.
Trey Turner, who's 2 for 2, and in this series now has 7 hits in a row against the Orioles.
Come on, it's not this easy, Trey.
Speaking of sevens, here's Trey Turner, his 8th consecutive hit. Turner to center. Did he get it? Yes, he did. Game over.
Are you kidding me? What else can Trey Turner do for you? 2 home runs tonight and a walk-off homer. Trey Turner is the man.
Line drive, and that's it. The magic number is down to 1. The Nationals have done their part. Now they'll wait and see if the Phillies can do theirs to eliminate the Mets.
They're sprinting into the clubhouse, folks. Sprinting.
Now it's all over up in New York. So the Nationals have won the National League Eastern Division title.